The murder. Quote, "The horrible mutilation of the body of Mary Fagan proves that the child was in the hands of a beast unspeakable." End quote. The Jewish-owned National Pencil Company was closed for business on Saturday, April 26, 1913, but not for the traditional Jewish Sabbath. It was closed for Confederate Memorial Day in honor of the dead and aging soldiers who had fought with valor but in vain to maintain America's most profitable economic institution, black slavery. Frank arrived at the Forsyth Street factory at about 8:30 a.m., and attended to routine paperwork in his second-floor office. The factory payday was usually Saturday at 12 noon, but given the holiday, the payoff time had been moved up to Friday. Frank expected the few who had missed it to come on Saturday. Mary Fagan had asked her friend and co-worker, Helen Ferguson, to pick up the $1.20 due her on Friday, just as she had on two past occasions. But this time, Helen was told by Leo Frank, quote, "I can't let you have it," end quote. So Mary would have to come herself the next day to be paid. No reason for the refusal was given. By Saturday noon, several factory employees had arrived, taken care of their business with Frank, and departed. Two carpenters renovating the fourth floor were still in the building. A black janitor named Jim Conley was stationed on the first floor, and Frank was alone on the second floor in his office when Mary Fagan arrived shortly after noon. Earlier that week, Mary had been laid off from her job operating a machine that attached erasers to pencils. The sheet brass that formed the metal bands that hold the erasers to the pencils had run out, leaving Mary without employment until the metal could be restocked. Frank met Mary in his office shortly after noon, and gave her an envelope with her pay. She then asked him if the expected shipment of metal had yet arrived. Mary was, in effect, asking Frank whether she should expect to come back to work on Monday. Frank said to her, quote, "I don't know," end quote. The events from this point forward have been in dispute for nearly a century. Prosecutors convinced a jury that Frank's ambiguous answer, quote, "I don't know," end quote, was in reality a ploy designed to lure Mary down the hall and into the secluded back storage room, ostensibly to see whether the metal shipment had indeed arrived. Frank's attorneys would later dispute this, claiming that he had answered her with a firm, quote, "no," end quote. But the detective who first testified of Frank's uncertain reply had been hired by Frank himself. Alone with the girl, prosecutors contended, Frank closed the door behind them and lustfully forced himself upon her. She resisted, and in the struggle, Frank struck Mary in the face, causing her to fall backward, her head striking the steel handle on one of the machines. The impact gouged the back of her head and knocked her unconscious. Frank, fearing the consequences if she were to regain consciousness and make the assault known, wrapped a cord around Mary's throat and strangled her to death. The cord was wound so tightly that it remained embedded in her neck when the undertaker later removed Mary's body from the factory. It was then, prosecutors say, that a panicked Leo Frank summoned the factory's black janitor, James Conley, swore him to secrecy, and ordered him to help move the body to the basement. Conley and Frank carried Mary's body to the elevator, and upon reaching the basement, dragged her body across the dirt floor to a final resting place near a trash pile by the furnace. Both men then returned to Frank's second-floor office, where he gave Conley a pad of paper and ordered him to write as Frank dictated. Conley wrote note after note, but the efforts of the barely literate janitor were unable to satisfy his agitated boss. A total of 4 notes were written, all to appear as if they were scrawled by the dying girl herself fingering her assailant, a black man. Frank then ordered Conley to return later that day to burn the girl's remains in the basement furnace, promising him a cash reward and threatening to put the notes by the body. Conley left the factory, never to return that day. At 1:10 p.m., shortly after Conley left, Frank left for lunch at his home so as not to diverge from his customary routine. Frank returned to the factory at approximately 3 o'clock p.m. and waited in vain for Conley, and, unable to incinerate the body himself, left two cryptic notes next to the dead girl. At 4 o'clock p.m., another black employee, night watchman Newt Lee, arrived at the factory to work his overnight shift. He had been employed at the factory for 3 weeks, but this was the first time he had encountered a locked front door. Lee used his key to pass through, but Frank rushed from his office to inform Lee that he did not need him until 6 o'clock p.m. Lee asked if he could stay in the factory to rest for the next 2 hours. Even though the factory was completely empty, Frank refused this request and sent Lee away. Lee returned promptly at 6, and Frank this time let him punch in and begin his duties as night watchman. Moments later, a white former employee named James Gant arrived at the front door unexpectedly and asked to retrieve some shoes he said he had left at the factory. Frank had fired Gant 2 weeks before and appeared startled by Gant's presence. Frank refused his request, telling Gant that he had seen the custodian throw out a pair of shoes. Gant countered that he had left 2 pairs, whereupon Frank relented and allowed his former bookkeeper into the factory, but ordered Lee to escort him as Frank left for home. Gant found both pairs of shoes and left. Less than an hour later, at 7 o'clock p.m., Frank called Lee at the factory and asked if everything was all right, something he had not done before. Frank would later claim that he had called the factory to make sure that James Gant had left. But Lee testified that Frank did not ask about Gant. At 3 o'clock a.m. Sunday morning, Lee again made his hourly rounds, and while in the basement, he noticed a strange heap in the distance that appeared to be a body. At first, he thought that some co-workers had played a trick on him, but he soon realized he had found the dead body of a white girl. Immediately, Lee telephoned Leo Frank, but strangely, none of the 4 adults at Frank's home answered. Lee then called the police, who arrived at the factory within minutes. The investigating officers found that the body, clothing, and face of Mary Fagan were dirty from having been dragged across the filthy basement floor. They found 2 notes next to her body. The police immediately arrested the black night watchman, Newt Lee. Soon thereafter, as leads and information surfaced, they arrested the fired white employee who had come for his shoes, James Gant. A former streetcar conductor and friend of Mary's named Arthur Mullinax, and a 19-year-old black elevator operator at the factory named Gordon Bailey. Shortly after 7 o'clock Sunday morning, officers went to Leo Frank's house to question him. 2 days later, they arrested him for the murder of Mary Fagan. The case against Leo Frank. The immediate arrest of the nearest black man was standard procedure in America, and had sufficed up until the Fagan murder case as state-of-the-art policing. Indeed, night watchman Newt Lee was charged with the crime while standing in the basement after leading police to the body. By practice tradition, it would be only a matter of hours before the requisite lynch mob would assemble and take care of its gory responsibilities. Even the Atlanta Georgian, one of the 3 Atlanta dailies that seized upon the case as major breaking news, reported, quote, "The theory that the crime was the work of a Negro held full sway and was assiduously followed by detectives until Sunday afternoon," end quote. Such was the hyper-racial climate in the American South, where its worst transgressions were automatically assigned to black people. But peculiar and problematic elements of the crime undermine traditional white Southern assumptions. Lee's arrival at the factory long after the estimated time of Mary Fagan's death, his calm and cooperative demeanor, and the brutality of this, quote, "most foul and unnatural murder," end quote, troubled authorities and forced a retreat from their knee-jerk ritual. Adding to their concern was the noticeably nervous demeanor of factory superintendent Leo Frank, the last person to see Mary Fagan alive. When detectives appeared at his door early Sunday morning to inform him of the crime, he was standoffish and argumentative, insisting that he have a cup of coffee before he would accompany the police to the crime scene. He had not answered the early morning phone calls from his night watchman or the 2 phone calls from police. and he sent his bath-robed wife to answer the door, even though he was fully clothed. The police at the scene described Frank as, quote, extremely nervous, end quote, quote, quivering, end quote, overwrought, end quote, and, quote, pale, end quote. According to one officer at the scene, Frank did not even ask what had occurred. Quote, I didn't tell him what had happened, and he didn't ask me. End quote. Frank was brought to the pencil factory, where he appeared so nervous that he could not operate the elevator to the basement. The factory personnel manager, N.V. Darley, had to take the controls to accomplish that simple task. A policeman detailed to watch the factory from the street reported that Frank came to the window many times, nervously rubbing his hands. This behavior contrasted noticeably with that of the night watchman Newt Lee, who, with 62 lynchings of American black men, women, and children in the previous year, had every reason to be terrified. Lee showed no signs of anxiety as he brought authorities to the body and recounted every detail of his day. Other actions and behaviors police observed in the first moments of the investigation fed their suspicions about Leo Frank. When Frank was taken to the morgue to identify the body, the undertaker pulled back the curtain, concealing the dead girl, but Frank refused to look at her. Newt Lee reported that the gaslight in the basement had been turned down to its lowest level, but that he had left it, quote, burning bright, end quote, the night before. It was suspected that the murderer did this to conceal the victim from the night watchman so that he could later return to dispose of the body. Even though he was not yet a suspect and had not been charged with any crime, Frank hired Georgia's most celebrated lawyer, Luther Rosser, and the nationally renowned Pinkerton Detective Agency. The police saw those hirings as suspicious behavior for an innocent man. From the first confrontation with police, Frank maintained that he did not know Mary Fagan. But when an opportunity arose to shift suspicion onto the former employee who had come to recover his shoes, James M. Gant, Frank told police that Gant had shown interest in courting the girl. Frank's sudden knowledge of the girl and an alleged amorous relationship alarmed investigators. The physical evidence collected at the factory only fueled suspicion of the B'nai B'rith leader. It appeared that a violent confrontation had occurred in the rear section of the second floor, the same floor where Leo Frank's office was located. A splattering of blood on the floor was found, along with a few strands of hair, on a machine handle, identified as belonging to the victim. Only Leo Frank and Mary Fagan were known to have been on this floor after the noon hour. A witness said that on the morning of the murder, Frank, quote, had a club which he used to play with, in his hand, and he was carrying it around, end quote. And when Frank was arrested, police confiscated a pocket knife, quote, he had been in the habit of carrying, end quote, of a kind that might have been used to cut the cord found tightly wound around Mary's neck and the part of her undergarment found under her head to catch the blood. Frank had emphatically claimed that he never left his office during the probable time of the murder, but a factory employee named Montine Stover came forward to say that she had also come for her pay that day and waited for Frank in his empty office for 5 full minutes before leaving empty-handed. George Epps, a 14-year-old friend of the murdered girl, said that Mary told him that she was afraid of Frank because he had, quote, winked at, end quote, quote, flirted with, end quote, and made advances toward her. And in a bombshell statement, the black woman who was the cook at Frank's home, Manola McKnight, said that she had overheard Frank's wife and her mother discussing Frank's confession to the crime on the night of the murder. Frank's wife made a brief initial visit to the jail that held her husband, but did not actually see or talk to him, and she did not return again for at least 2 weeks. For many, Mrs. Frank's absence lent credence to the cook's original statement, and led to the assumption that Frank's own wife believed him to be guilty. The layers of evidence seemed to lead consistently in one direction, away from the traditional suspect, the, quote, Negro night watchman, end quote, and toward Leo Frank. And yet more was to come. Though much of it could be classified as circumstantial, by April 29th, 3 days after the murder of Mary Fagan, enough of the evidence had been found to meet the standard of, quote, probable cause, end quote, and justified Frank's arrest. The Framing of a Black Man. Newt Lee. Quote, "There was much talk of lynching, but it was aimless talk, directed against no one in particular. The general opinion seemed to be that a Negro must be guilty, and the police did all they could to find a darkie on whom they could fix the crime." End quote. Herbert Asbury. Within 24 hours of the Saturday murder, Leo Frank's crisis management team was quickly taking form. On Sunday afternoon, Frank met with several members of the B'nai B'rith, the Jewish organization for which he served as president, including several of its lawyers. The Montag brothers, owners of the National Pencil Company, hired Luther Z. Rosser, who was not only the most prominent attorney in Georgia, but also the new law partner of the state's governor-elect, John M. Slayton, the significance of which would play out many months later as the case moved to its ultimate climax. Later that day, Frank himself hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency, stating publicly that he wanted the Pinkertons to assist the city detectives in ferreting out the perpetrator of the crime. The professional and well-heeled pillars of Atlanta's Jewish elite came to Frank's defense, it soon became apparent, with a scorched-earth, all-or-nothing approach to his exoneration. Certainly, Frank had to be cleared of the heinous crime, but the explicit targeting of other individuals, black individuals, to shoulder the blame became a clear objective of Frank's Jewish defenders. In his behavior and comportment, the factory's night watchman appeared to be exactly the kind of black man the white South was proud of. In his mid-50s, he had been born into slavery and had always been known to perform diligently those menial tasks fitted for the sons of Ham. Newt Lee was loyal and devoted to his responsibilities at the factory. But 3 days after the murder, the terrified black man sat handcuffed to a chair at Atlanta police headquarters, where he emphatically swore on a Bible that he had merely found the evidence of someone else's crime. And despite headlines salivating for his lynching, police found that Lee's story was unwavering, logical, and corresponded with the evidence they had collected so far. But Frank's people were lobbying hard to keep the police focused on the man Frank himself trusted to oversee and protect a building filled with advanced industrial machinery and a workforce of young white girls. He now publicly insisted that Lee either was the killer or had direct knowledge of the crime. And sensing the mood of Atlanta's white men, Frank added fuel to the public rage against Lee. Quote, "Under the present conditions of morals in Atlanta, these low characters undoubtedly have grown worse. That our janitor," end quote, Lee, quote, "was bribed to allow them," end quote, "criminals," quote, "in the building, while a suspicion to me, is not an unbelievable suggestion. Such fellows as these might be expected to stoop to such things." End quote. Yet police remained unconvinced of Lee's guilt. They had found too many clues that seemed outside Lee's abilities and range, so they asked Frank to help them tighten the screws on his night watchman. Just 50 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, white employers of the South were seen as having slave master-like powers over their black employees. So when the police told Frank, who was then under arrest and in custody, that they thought he, quote, "could get more out of the nigger," end quote, "than they could," quote, Frank readily consented, end quote. And on April 29th, met with Newt Lee one-on-one. Lee later told of the event in his sworn testimony. Quote, "They went and got Mr. Frank and brought him in, and he sat down next to the door. He dropped his head and looked down. We were all alone. I said, 'Mr. Frank, it's mighty hard for me to be handcuffed here for something I don't know anything about.' He said, 'What's the difference? They have got me locked up and a man guarding me.' I said, 'Mr. Frank, do you believe I committed that crime?' And he said, 'No, Newt, I know you didn't, but I believe you know something about it.' I said, 'Mr. Frank, I don't know a thing about it, no more than finding the body.' He said, 'We are not talking about that now. We will let that go. If you keep that up, we will both go to hell.' Then the officers both came in." End quote. After emerging from the strange session, Frank claimed, quote, that he had made every possible effort to get the truth, end quote, and that Lee, quote, still sticks to his original story, end quote. Odd as it seems for an innocent man, Frank had asked no actual questions of Lee. He had simply bided time and appeared to care little for the chance to gain vital information from an actual suspect who might add more pieces to the puzzle. In fact, the only question asked during the interrogation was the one Lee asked of Frank. Quote, do you believe I committed that crime? End quote. Detective Harry Scott caught a portion of the session and provided an unusual description. Quote, Mr. Frank was extremely nervous at that time. He was very squirmy in his chair, crossing one leg after the other, and didn't know where to put his hands. He was moving them up and down his face, and he hung his head a great deal of the time while the Negro was talking to him. He breathed very heavily and took deep swallows and sighed and hesitated somewhat. End quote. And while Frank remained in custody, his team of hired agents appeared to have been operating in the shadows to establish a criminal profile for Newt Lee. The evidence of their extralegal actions began to trouble Atlanta Chief of Detectives Newport A. Lanford, who suspected that there was an organized operation to throw detectives off the trail, and he brought his concerns to the newspapermen following the case. Under the Atlanta Constitution May 4th headline, Imposters Busy in Sleuth Roles in Fagan Case, it was revealed that two unknown men were posing as Pinkerton detectives and interviewing key witnesses. The article opened with a question, quote, what interests are promoting the planting of evidence in the Mary Fagan mystery? End quote. Quote, not only are we being opposed, but evidence is being planted. We have discovered numerous signs of plants in the past few days and are not surprised at any frame-up. End quote. One of the, quote, bogus detectives, end quote, had approached Mary's parents and for an hour questioned them on their daughter's, quote, character and habits, end quote. Another approached the boy who had last seen Mary on the trolley moments before her murder. Harry Scott, the lead Pinkerton detective in the southern region, was assigned to the case but claimed to have no idea who these imposters were or on whose behalf they were operating. Scott had publicly taken a strong stand to do exactly what Frank had asked of him, to find the murderer of Mary Fagan. By law, private detectives were required to share evidence and work closely with police, but that was not why industrialists hired the Pinkertons, who specialized in violent union busting and strike breaking, not crime solving. In this respect, Scott may have been intolerably honest to the Frank crew, who very likely engaged a second faction of Pinkerton agents to pursue a darker agenda. It was apparent to many on the Frank team that Harry Scott had become convinced of Frank's guilt and would be of limited use going forward. Whoever they were, it didn't take much investigative expertise to know that no black man had the kind of money, influence, and resources to enlist a stealthy team of white agents with the ability to interrogate witnesses, plant evidence, and then disappear into the shadows. Frank's time slip slip-up. Those falsely generated clues framing up the case all pointed directly to Newt Lee as the murderer, and the first of those clues came by the way of Leo Frank himself. Lee's duty at the factory was to check all four floors every half hour, and then punch his time slip after completing each round. When police questioned Frank at the factory shortly after the body was discovered, he affirmed that Lee's time slip was correct, verifying that Lee had dutifully performed his scheduled rounds up until the moment he discovered Mary's body. But police inexplicably did not take the slip as evidence, leaving it with Frank. The next day, Frank and the company of his lawyers reversed himself and said that he was mistaken, and that the time slip, quote, contained errors, end quote, in the form of, quote, three skips, end quote. And, quite remarkably, Frank's new reading of the time slip showed a block of time unaccounted for. Enough time for Lee to have gone home, conceal evidence of his crime, and return to work. Frank explained away his mistake by claiming that he and his manager, N.V. Darley, had at first only, quote, casually, end quote, reviewed the time slip. Police found it difficult to believe that the meticulous superintendent would have missed a single discrepancy, much less three skips. It was Frank who calculated the pay and prepared the payroll weekly for many years for over 100 employees, using these very time slips. That both he and his personnel manager were mistaken on the most important time slip they had ever analyzed strained the credulity of investigators. But it was this miraculous piece of evidence that made Newt Lee the prime suspect, and it was the raw meat the voracious Atlanta press needed to scream in a Tuesday afternoon headline, repeated Wednesday, quote, "Lee's guilt proved," end quote, and to further predict his lynching. The Constitution was, in the meantime, editorializing that the murder was, quote, "the most revolting crime in the history of Atlanta that has no local parallel in sheer horror and barbarity, committed by some human beast with more than jungle cruelty and less than jungle mercy," end quote, with, quote, "elements of horror and degeneracy that defy the written word," end quote. Frank's corrected time slip was enough for the Atlanta Georgian to declare the case closed. Additional clues furnished by the head of the pencil factory were responsible for the closing net around the Negro watchman. With the solution of the mystery at hand came the further information that what suspicion had rested on Frank was being rapidly swept away by the damaging evidence against the black man. Reports that a, quote, "mob," end quote, of white men was being formed to lynch Lee caused Chief of Police James L. Beavers to activate 50 mounted police at the jail to protect him. The Atlanta Constitution reported just how close Lee was to a violent death. When Lee was brought to the crime scene in a police car, quote, "threatening remarks came from the crowd that thronged around the machine," end quote, automobile. Quote, "he ought to be lynched," said a heavyset man who edged close. "Yes," said another, "and I'd help do it," end quote. While many Atlanta whites were deciding whether Lee would be destroyed by rope, bullet, or fire, others were not so quick to accept the time slip evidence at face value. The Atlanta Constitution slowed Georgia's roll, reporting, quote, "some theorists believe evidence was planted. They say that the watchman's clock evidence is flimsy and openly crude," end quote. There was more that disturbed the Constitution reporters. On Monday, April 28th, police investigators entered Newt Lee's residence and found a, quote, "fancy," end quote, linen shirt, apparently covered with blood at the bottom of a clothes hamper. The shirt was indeed his, but police quickly noticed it had not been worn. The blood stain was on the inside, and it appeared to have been wiped in blood as one would use a rag to wipe a table. Strangely, just moments before the search, Leo Frank's attorney and fellow B'nai B'rith member, Herbert Haas, had suggested to detectives that they examine Frank's soiled clothes bin for potential evidence, ostensibly to clear his client. Investigators saw this miraculously timed suggestion as Haas's attempt to bait detectives to examine the laundry hampers of both suspects. And though Frank's lawyers had directed investigators to search Newt Lee's clothes bin, Frank himself had made a suspicious change of clothes on the day of the murder. He had worn a brown suit on that Saturday, a blue suit on Sunday, and then the brown suit again on Monday. In those times before the widespread use of washing machines and dry cleaners, men wore the same work suit every day of the Monday to Saturday work week and another suit on Sunday, dedicated for church going. On the day of the murder, Frank went home for lunch and took an exceptionally long time of 2 hours to return to the factory, with one of his servants testifying that he did not actually eat anything at all and left almost as soon as he arrived. Frank had both the time and the opportunity to change and clean his suit during his lunch break. In fact, Frank does admit to cleaning up at a critical time. Quote, "I took a bath Saturday night at my home. I changed my clothes. The clothes that I changed are at home, and this is the suit of clothes I was wearing Saturday," end quote. Frank's change of clothes during this critical weekend cloaked him in yet another layer of suspicion. The orchestrated triad of events. The time slip change, the calculated suggestion of where damning evidence against the Negro might be found, and the finding of that evidence. Only confirmed police suspicion that the forces now associated with Leo Frank's defense were actively attempting to implicate Newt Lee. The Atlanta Constitution was reticent about outing Frank's conspirators. Instead, the paper meekly asked, quote, "Is the Watchman suspect a victim of planted evidence? Is the real murderer striving to convict an innocent man? It is plausible." End quote. Chief of Detectives Newport Lanford declared to reporters that somebody was, quote, "blocking Fagan investigation, silencing witnesses, and planting evidence." End quote. The Bloody Shirt episode became the single incident that solidified police suspicion of the B'nai B'rith leader, leading them on Tuesday, April 29th, 3 days after the murder of Mary Fagan, to place him under arrest. Only the bungling ineptitude of the Leo Frank forces saved Newt Lee from being lynched for the murder of Mary Fagan. Lee would remain in jail, but alive and under the protection of police, who now saw him more as a valued witness than as a murder suspect. The physical evidence may have been circumstantial and inconclusive, but the actions of Leo Frank and his representatives had dissipated any lingering doubt. Atlanta police turned their full attention to building the case against Leo M. Frank. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.